So we're going to talk about what low end actually is in music, why it is important and why it is difficult to get right. And then we give you some tactical advice to improve your low end in your songs and give you better results in the end. This is the Self-Recording Band Podcast, the show where we help you make exciting records on your own, wherever you are, DIY style. Let's go. Hello and welcome to the Self-Recording Band Podcast. I am your host, Benedict Tyne, and I'm back here with my co-host and friend, Malcolm Owen Flood. Or he's
Hello.
Back. Hello.
Yes. Yeah, I'm really glad to be back. It made me really sad to miss an episode. Yeah. That was a bummer.
Yeah, totally. It was weird to do a solo episode. I missed you.
I'll do my best not to let it happen again.
Yeah, for sure. Awesome. So we are a little behind on episodes as well. So by the time we're recording this, like I think 2 days from now, it will already be published. But We're getting it done. We're not missing a single episode, as I said last time. And this one today, I didn't even ask you how you are. I want to do that first. How are you, Michael?
It's fine.
I'm just so happy to be able to do it so that I completely forgot to ask.
No, it's fine. I'm great. Thank you for asking. Yeah, I'm just really glad to be back back home after a few weeks away in the city. And yeah, things are great, man. Thank you. Thank
awesome.
You. How are you?
I'm
How is Germany?
Well. Germany has entered a second lockdown, like a lockdown light is what they call it.
But we are in a similar thing.
Yeah. But other than that, for me personally, it's been good. Closer to getting the damn course finished that I've been working on this whole year.
I am so excited for the course to be finished.
Yeah, me too. So if you are on that waiting list, by the way, it won't be long. The wait will be over very, very soon. And I've prepared something special for you as a way to say thank you for waiting so long and for joining the waitlist early. If you're not on that waiting list, go to theselfrecordingband.com/academy-waiting-list. And you'll be notified first when the course come out, and there will be a special like goodie for you in there.
Awesome. In case you are a first time listener and you have no idea what we're talking about, there is a course called the Self-Recording Band course. Is that what it's called? I just assumed it's
the Self-Recording Band Academy, it's called.
Academy, sorry, yeah. And that is like the whole reason that we started this podcast, is that it's like a big flagship educational course that Benny has made, and it covers everything, absolutely everything.
That's true, that's true. I wouldn't say it's the main reason for us starting this podcast, though. So we just like, I mean, the whole platform is definitely for sure, but we still continue the podcast even when the course is out, of course. So we want to provide value every week. It's not that we sell you a course and then we're disappearing. So, no. I think, to be honest, the course, we will talk about that when it's out or when it's closer to the actual release, but... to be honest, I think the course will be the logical next step after this podcast, and it will be the best way for me to provide everything I can, like full true value and like much more than we can do in this podcast. So if you want to go deeper, if you want to learn like everything about making a record on your own, this course is going to be for you. And it's just for those of you who just want to listen to the podcast, that's totally fine. But if you want to take it a step further and really dive in deep, then that course will be for you. But more on that in future episodes, yeah. So, yeah, other than that, it's been good here. It's been grinding away at the course and mixing records and doing podcasts.
Awesome. Awesome.
Cool.
Love mixing records.
Yeah. So, today's episode is, again, something that we did that quite often during the past couple of weeks. It's, again, something... in response to a question that our audience has. This time, it was not an email or a direct question from one of you, but it was something I discovered when I was looking at my analytics for my website, because I have an article on my website that is about low end and how to get it right before mixing. And I noticed, or Google notified me, that a lot of people are finding that article lately. And what they were searching for was like questions on what low end actually is, what it means. Like there seems to be confusion or a lack of information there, or at least an interest. People are searching for it a lot. And I got some questions like that in the community as well. So I figured we should do an episode on that topic to go along with that article. So we're going to talk about what low-end actually is in music, why it is important, and why it is difficult to get right. And then we give you some tactical advice, some like strategies and tactics on how what you can actually do in the recording and production phase to improve your low-end in your songs, to make mixing easier, and give you better results in the end.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, let's start by what low end actually is, because I think to us it's such a term we use all the time and we don't even think about it. But for many people, when they hear low end, when someone talks about music or a song, they don't actually maybe not even know what that means. So what? How would you describe it?
Yeah, there's a lot of terms in music that are pretty vague when it comes down to it, and low end is one of the more common ones, you know, and it actually means a lot of different things is the problem and what we're going to be jumping into today, because people might refer to low end and be talking about the bass guitar, or they might be talking about the kick drum. They might be talking about a synth bass or an organ or something. Like, you don't really know what they're talking about until you dig into it, or you just have a good understanding of this term and the context will kind of illuminate that for you. But low end as a whole is, I think, where we want to start. And that is the overall bass portion of your mix, right? And we're going to talk into like how that can be divided into different kind of categories of low end. But I think when somebody just says the low end of the mix, we're talking from subs all the way to like low mids. At least that's how I would refer to it. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Agreed with everything you said. The funny thing is I just Googled it myself to see what low end means and like if there's a definition or anything for it. And when I wrote that article, I did that. And I found multiple websites that like use that quote, but it says low end refers to bass frequency signals that are below 250 hertz. So as I said in the article as well, while I don't agree that there is like a certain frequency where the low end starts, I think it's still a pretty good description. Like it's low mids and down, like what you just said. And basically It's the lower portion of anything. So low end could even mean, to me, at least the way I think about it, it could even mean if you're talking about a single instrument and it's an instrument that's not bass heavy, it still has a low end. It's just the lowest part of that signal, you know? So
yeah, like a vocal has some low end for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. A snare has a lot of low end, but isn't really considered a bass instrument.
Yes, exactly. And that brings us to the next point here where we need to define those, like how the low end can be like divided, or what the different meanings of low end basically. Like when we're talking about low end, we can mean the lowest part of a single instrument. When we talk about a whole mix that covers the full spectrum, there's more to it. We can view the low end as a whole from a certain frequency down, or we can look at certain areas within that low end. So if we start way down, there's something you could call like sub bass, or like, yeah, infrasonics would be like a scientific term, I think, like stuff that you can't really hear but feel a lot. I think infra is even like below what we can hear, but like the sub low end, the sub bass, the really 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 low frequencies that only huge speakers can reproduce, or headphones. So that's one thing.
What I find is most commonly being referred to as low end when you're talking to mixers.
Yeah.
Like if you send your mix off to get some mix notes from somebody and they say the low end, they're often talking about that, the like sub area and lower bass area being out of whack or really tight or whatever the context is, but not always. And sorry, I want you to continue now, because that is the not always part of the conversation needs to be addressed as well.
Yeah, you're totally right. And what's good about what you just said, what's also good to know is that, yes, I think mixers refer to that as low end, the sub portion of it. But the funny thing is that not everyone does that. And musicians oftentimes, when they say, or at least in my experience, when a band comes to me and says, like with the mix notes or whatever, and says they want more low end on bass, for example, on the bass guitar, oftentimes what they mean is they want more 100 or 150, or like something that's actually audible on their small system that they're listening on. So sometimes they want the upper bass region or even lower mids, but they're calling it like low end, or they sometimes they even call it sub bass, even though it's not. So it's a very, that's why it's so difficult also, this whole topic. People use different language for different things. People think they can hear sub bass even though they're listening on a phone or on whatever, and like all those complications.
But that is why we're doing this, because if you understand, like, essentially we've broken it down into sub, low bass, upper bass, and low mids. So like kind of four quadrants, if you will. And if you are trying to figure out a low end problem and you know you can only, like, you just need to look in these four spots to kind of figure out what you're looking for, like, that'll narrow it down quite a bit, right? And it helps you kind of identify, where do I need to be looking?
Yeah, totally. So what comes next after the very low sub portion? So if you could solo, just to go back to that, if you could solo that very low sub portion of the low end that I was just talking about, you couldn't make out a certain instrument probably. Maybe you could feel the kick drum beat or whatever, but it's more like a weight, and it's something you can feel more than you can actually hear it. There's not much note information, if at all, in there. There's not much musical information in there. It's like a very low pulse and size and weight to the whole thing.
Yeah.
But when
it's almost like the feeling of a subwoofer moving.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. The air being pushed by a subwoofer. Or like with headphones, good headphones can reproduce that as well. You don't feel it as much, though. You can actually hear it on headphones. It's a little different experience, but still, they can reproduce it. And it's still, even on headphones, I think it gives, it defines the size and like the weight of something a lot.
Yes. It's funny because when you do solo it, it seems very inconsequential. And like it's not really going to matter that much if it was there or not. But when it is placed with the rest of the picture, it adds a whole lot to like for a kick drum, for example. It really adds an enormous amount of size when you get that really sub stuff in there into the mix. But when it's just listened to on its own, it kind of just feels like it's just like an impact or a noise that's irrelevant, but it really is hugely important.
Yeah, absolutely. So if, as we move up from there, like if you're looking at the whole frequency spectrum, down is like way below low hertz numbers, and up means higher pitch, higher notes, higher frequencies. And when the hertz number increases, so like if we go from 30 to 60, we went up an octave, for example. So we move up the frequency spectrum now. And what is next? What's the next part of the low end? And what would you hear there if you'd solo it?
So now we're into lower bass, right?
Yeah.
Which is going to be where, like, you're probably going to find some fundamentals there for like a bass guitar or a kick drum, potentially,
yeah.
Right? Kind of 50, 60 hertz. And so actually, you know, I'm going to pull up your cheat sheet. If you haven't already, go to theselfrecordingband.com/how-to-get-your-low-end-right, I believe, right?
Yeah, the short URL is just /low-end, and then you get redirected to that.
Yeah, he's got like this perfect cheat sheet that we can use in our own episode. Where was that? Bass guitar lives in the 73 to 146 area for second and fourth harmonic, octaves of D. Okay, you're in a drop D. Okay, my God, this article's awesome. But yeah, this is actually really cool. I would keep this up as you're working, because Benny's actually gone through and he's like figured out, well, not figured out, but he's listed for convenience anyways, like the frequency of an E note on a bass is 41.2 hertz. Or if you're on drop D, it's 36.7 hertz. Or C, you know, going down even further. And then guitars as well, you know, there's now 82.4 for like an open E string. And by the way, like this is assumed knowledge, but some people probably don't know this, that if you double the hertz, you've got an octave of a harmonic. So the low E on the bass being 41.2, where it is 82.4. So just double it. And that is now your guitar's harmonic.
Fundamental for the guitar. Yeah.
What was your question now?
What's in the lower bass area? And you totally explained that right. Those fundamentals. I mean, the bass guitar fundamentals, especially if you tune down, they even go into the really sub area, like a C at 32 hertz is really, really low. But like the fundamentals around, like I'd say 40, 50, 60, 70 up there. And like the kick drum fundamental often between like 50 to 70 or something as well. Is also like lives there. And that was the question. What's kind of in there? And you already answered it basically. So I totally agree. So that's kind of the lower bass stuff. And I think mostly kick and bass guitar will live there, I guess.
Yeah. Maybe a little bit of your snare, depending. But this is a good place to mention like over under kind of bass techniques. Not that that's really relevant, but it's kind of a cool thing just to know and think about. But people often like to divide their mixing into either having the bass above the kick drum or below the kick drum in frequencies. So either your bass guitar is taking up the sub stuff or your kick drum's taking up the sub stuff and your bass focus is in that lower bass above the subs kind of thing. And you don't have to follow that. Like, that's not a rule or anything, but it is kind of a cool way to think about it, is like, what is taking up the bottom? Is it your bass guitar or is it your kick drum?
Sure. And we'll go back to that later in this episode. It's an important concept and absolutely also for you if you are not mixing. If you are, it's even more important. But if you're not mixing, it's still really important, because what you record and how you record it and how the source sounds often dictates that decision, like already. Mm-hmm. Depending on, like, if you get a... Yeah, we dive into that. But depending on what the source material sounds like, that decision has already been made, basically. And you can you can make that decision while you're recording and producing. And how you do that and why you should do that, well, we're going to talk about that. But that's true. Then we move up to like upper bass. I mean, you could divide it even further with mid bass and whatever, but just for convenience, I would say sub, low bass, upper bass. And that's where we get into this like guitar territory, I'd say. Like the first, like the harmonics and the upper bass notes, and also the fundamentals of the guitar, actually.
Mm. Yeah. Guitars should have more low end than you think. It's my personal opinion.
Yeah.
Because it's easy. It's just like we say in this podcast all the time, that bass guitar should have way more than just bass, right? It's the same with guitars. Guitars need to have more low end than you think. But like you're now talking above 100 for sure, up to like kind of, I don't know, it kind of depends how hard, like we're talking upper bass, but also sneaking into low mids. This is where it gets really blurry for me.
Yeah.
It's almost like depending on the instrument that I start thinking about it, right? Like, because electric guitars, depending on the part, can feel like 200 or 300, can feel pretty bassy if it's like a palm muted thing, you know?
Yeah.
But that's definitely in your low mids as well.
That brings us back to this whole concept where we said like low end, what low end is depends on what you're looking at, like a single instrument, a single element in the arrangement. Mm-hmm. Whatever the lowest thing of that is the low end of it. But with another instrument, it can be a different thing. So with the guitar example, 200, 300 can be the low end and can feel like a low end. Whereas with a bass guitar, it feels like mud and mid-range and growl, because the low end is way below that. So it's a different thing. But with guitars, it feels like full and heavy and massive. So it's, depending on what you're looking at.
Yeah, like low end is just not a technical term when it comes down to it. It's a descriptive term that needs to be applied to whatever you're talking about, where frequencies like, you know, 40, 60 hertz, those kind of things, those don't move. 40 is always 40 hertz, 60 hertz is always 60 hertz. But how 60 hertz sounds on different instruments does change. So that's why low end needs to be adaptable as a term.
Absolutely. What you also find in the upper low end here, the upper bass here, because before we get into like the low mid-range stuff, is like a different quality of a kick drum, for example. Like the weight, the size, and the fundamental is down there in the lower bass area, but up there is like the knock and the impact, like a quicker, lower transient. It's like, I don't know, to me this area feels punchy and quick, and it's like something knocking you, like hitting you in the chest a little more, whereas the low part of it, the fundamental, is like feels longer, less defined, but bigger. That's the way I perceive it. So whenever a kick drum is heavy in the like 100 or 150 area, it's like really knocking and really like it sounds like someone's hitting it very hard, compared to the more pillowy, softer, fuller, really low end. So at least that's how I perceive it. So it's both belong to a kick drum and they make the whole kick drum sound, but the balance between the two can decide how the kick drum feels. So
I agree with that. Yeah. And another reason I like having this conversation is that it gets people to think about each instrument in a broader way, not just like, okay, the kick drum has a lot of really washy 30 hertz, like we're done. It's very full down there. But it's like, well, that's only just this little part of the picture, and it might be the exact opposite of what you want. You have to think about low end across the board. And like, that is that knock there? Is it, do you want a present kick drum that's really close and has that like impact kind of thud? Because, you know, that's very different than having just that sub thing there, the pillow, like you said.
Hey friend, this is Benedict from the selfrecordingband.com, and if you are producing your own songs, I have a question for you. Do you ever listen to your music and feel like something is just off? Maybe the drums sound weak, or the guitar tone bothers you, maybe the vocals don't really cut through the mix, or the whole thing just doesn't sound finished and professional, but you can't really put your finger on it? I know you want to release big, punchy, professional sounding songs, right? The type of authentic, unique art that connects with your audience on a deep level. But you're just not sure what's missing with your recordings. Somehow you just can't connect all the dots. And I get it, the amount of things to learn and all the conflicting information out there can be really overwhelming. Especially if you're a lone wolf trying to figure it all out on your own, right? Now here's the good news. Whether you've been self-recording for years, or you're just setting up your first home studio, I want to offer you my personal one-on-one help. As long as you are determined to put in the work, I'm offering a limited amount of free one-on-one coaching calls with me. On this hour-long call, we'll dive deep into your recordings and create a personalized roadmap for you to finally solve the issues you're struggling with, so that you can release music that you'll be proud of forever. If you are ready to see and believe that it's actually possible to achieve your goals and make the records you've always wanted to make, then go to theselfrecordingband.com/call and apply for one of my limited coaching spots. I can assure you that making exciting and successful DIY records is very doable. We've done it, lots of other people have done it, you can do it as well. Talk soon, theselfrecordingband.com/call.
Yeah, absolutely. That brings us to the why, actually. I mean, let's cover the low mid-range real quick, and then let's go to the why, because that's part of it. What's in the lower mid-range? I mean, you kind of described it already. What else is there? The low end of the guitars? I mean, like the
low end of guitars, vocals even, you know, snares, definitely. I mean, everything, actually. Yeah. I don't think there's an instrument that doesn't have some really important information in the low mids.
Yes.
Like, you don't need sub on your vocal, but you definitely need low mids.
Yes. And that's I think, the most, where it gets most tricky and difficult to get it right, because it's not clear where the bass ends and the mid-range starts, and everything is there, basically. Everything's clashing. It can end up super, like, being super muddy or super thin if you take it too far. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very, like, the whole low-end thing is not easy to do, and especially in the low mid-range, it's definitely a challenge. So I agree, everything's there. For some instruments, it's the fundamental and the weight and the size. And for others, it's more mud or growl or harmonics. But again, to sum it up, subs, more feel than you can more feel it more than you can actually hear it. Lower bass, fundamentals of the lowest instruments, can be a kick drum, can be a bass guitar, can be a synth bass or something, a low bass line that you program or something like that. Then upper bass can be the harmonics of the really low stuff, so already an octave above, or it can be the low end of new stuff that comes in this range, like can be fundamental of low tune guitars, can be snare information in there. And then, yeah, and then the lower mid range, where again, even higher stuff has the fundamentals there, and other stuff already has like harmonics there and like additional qualities, right, in addition to the very low information.
Yeah. We should just delete the first 15 minutes of this podcast and put what you just said. That was a great summary.
it's difficult to even talk about these things, and I always realize it once we are at it, actually. Like, before we start the episode, I always think, oh, that's going to be an easy one, and then while we're talking about it, I realize how difficult it can be to explain this.
Yeah, like, I feel like my answers are different than they would be if I had mixed a different song yesterday. Like, it's so dependent.
So dependent, yes. So why do we even care about getting this right, and why are people interested in the whole thing? So what does the low end actually do for for you as or for someone as a listener, because all the technical stuff aside, we want to make amazing records, amazing songs. We want people to feel something when they listen to the music. So which role does the low end play in that? Why is it so important to get it right?
Right. I find it easiest to pick, like, visualize a mix in terms of, like, size and density. And low end takes up the most space and can add the most density as well to, like, especially like a big rock mix is kind of what I'm picturing while having this conversation. And so even though it's not the most audible part of a mix, it kind of has the biggest impact on how the size and density is perceived, I think, anyways. So if you suck out all the low end, you're left with like just a lot of your mix feels empty. Right? It's like thin and empty, and it kind of feels like it's just missing a whole lot. Where if you have too much, you've got this big muddy mess. Everything's kind of like stepping on each other, and it's just way too dense. So space and density is like the terms that I mainly use and visualize with. And that's how I see it. So that's why it's so important, because it just makes such a big impact. A little too far, and your mix is destroyed. A little too little, and your mix is just, I mean, it sounds just like dated, because things are pretty full sounding these days.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I agree with that. Energy, size, it's the biggest ones. I think it carries a lot of the energy in that it's what makes you move, because you feel the song. Not you don't only hear it, but you feel it. That's the reason why, like, when you're in a club, you have these huge subwoofers and these huge
it's a very good
systems.
Point.
These wouldn't work if they were just like playing super loud stuff without low end, without subwoofers. It would be painful probably and not enjoyable, and you certainly wouldn't want to dance. But if you add the subwoofers to it, it's fun. So it just makes you move. You feel the song. You do not only hear it. It carries also the fundamental notes. It's just the foundation for a great experience when you're listening to a song.
Yeah. I mean, everybody likes a big fat kick drum. Like, it literally feels good to hear, right?
Yeah.
So that's why we care about this stuff. I just wanted to mention that if people are struggling to kind of figure out what we're talking about, just open up your DAW, throw up a kick drum or a bass guitar or even just a song, and grab an EQ, and using like high pass and low pass filters, you can just hone in on specific ranges of the mix and try and figure out what we're talking about. And if you pull up Benny's cheat sheet on his blog post there, that'll make it even more easy. And you could just, go and solo out everything under 30 or 40 hertz and hear what's happening down there on your favorite mix. And then go do the same thing from 40 to 80 or something. And just like break it down and kind of figure out where that mixer put things, right? Where that producer and mixer and band and arrangement and like how they made all of those pieces live together. And you'll really understand what we're talking about a lot more.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, that's a great exercise. I actually teach that. I need to go back to the course a little quick, because I actually teach that in the course as well. So that exercise is part of it, because I feel much of what we're talking about here, you need to experience that before you really get it. It's because it's so hard to describe it. But once you hear it, you'll know exactly what we're talking about. And if you do that a lot and listen to a lot of different songs and if you're listening to those to the low end and the specific areas of the low end, you just get a feeling for it, and it starts to become you start to notice when something is too much or not enough. But it's an exercise. It's practice. So
yes,
Definitely a good thing. Open up the DAW. Use whatever low-pass, high-pass filters you have, and then hone in on those specific areas of it. And you'll discover things that you might not have been aware of before. So it's pretty interesting to do that. I still do that a lot, actually. And I'm kind of surprised by some decisions sometimes. Some things are obvious, but it's always a great thing to see what my favorite like mixers did in certain songs.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. So we can agree on that. It's like very important to get right. And it's also difficult because, yeah, as Malcolm said, it can be muddy really quickly. It can be thin really quickly. A lot of things stepping, on each other's toes, like getting in the way of each other there. So it's hard to get it right, but it's important. Now, while you can definitely do a lot of it in mixing, and you can clean up things, you can make space for things, you can change the size of things, all that, you can do that in mixing. But you can and should make some of those decisions before it even it's time to mix. So mixing is like, I don't know, some things in mixing are, sometimes you need to do things in the low end to fix issues, and that's not good. Some other things you do anyways, and you kind of, it's just a part of making a great mix, but there should be too much fixing involved. So a lot of stuff that you can do in the production and recording stage can save your mixer from, or yourself, from having to do a lot of correction work, and you will end up with a much better result if you do that. And I would divide that into two things, two camps here, writing and arrangement decisions, and then the actual engineering decisions that you can make.
Yeah, that's the perfect way to think about it. It's like which instruments and what parts are being played, and then how are you going to capture those instruments and you know, using what gear and what microphones and what placements and stuff like that.
Yeah. So which low-end instruments do you have in your arrangement? It's different for everyone. It's like if you are a classic like rock band with like two guitars, bass, drums, vocals, maybe keys, whatever, then you probably have the kick drum, you have the bass, maybe you have some additional production in there, synth bass or something like that. And then you have
the piano.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The piano, Fender Rhodes can have low end, or organs can have low end. And then maybe like the low end of guitars, of course, and snare drums. So you have those low end instruments going on, and you need to think about what you have when each of those is actually playing and what they sound like just in the room, like what the source actually sounds like. Because some of them will naturally be very, very low and feel kind of massive and slower and bassier. Others will feel a little punchier. They will feel a little quicker. They might be a little higher up the spectrum with the fundamentals. And those instruments that you have and the way you play them and the way your instruments sound, the choice of instrument, the size of drums, for example, all that, that kind of already dictates what you have and what that sounds like together. And you can choose wisely here or make mistakes by choosing five things that are all in the exact same range. And it's going to lead to low-end buildup, to a muddy, undefined low-end. And you're going to have holes somewhere else because everything is covering the exact same area.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Like if you've got like an 8-string guitar and an even more stringed bass and then a sub bass, and they're all playing the lowest notes possible, then like what lives up top, you know, like what's going to be up there? Is your vocal just going to be hanging out in space, or is there another instrument that's kind of supporting it? It kind of always blows my mind, but the more balanced like the instrument arrangement is, when I get files to mix or master, it like the better it always seems to turn out. When you just said like, or you're going to have a hole somewhere else, I thought that was really great. It's like you want to fill all of these holes. And if there's something that's left empty, it should be intentional. So like you picture your EQ curve and something needs to be kind of living in all of those spots, I think.
Yes, exactly. And this might be a lot in your case, or it might be not as much. Like it could be just the kick and the bass drum and you need to find a space for each of those. But if you are like a metal band with, as Malcolm said, low down-tuned guitars, fast double kick drum, post-production, low synth bass lines, whatever, then you've got a whole lot of things going on down there and you need to think carefully what the purpose is of each of those elements, why you need each of them and how they will work together. And that's an exercise you need to do when you are writing and arranging, and you can make really clever decisions here, and you can make that, it can create a really dense, full low end without the annoying buildups and the boominess and the muddiness. And if you screw it up, you will have exactly that. it's just an exercise you need to do. You need to think about the tuning, the key of the song, the tuning of the kick drum. So if you like have Let's pull up my article again. Just an example. If you are tuning down to C and you're doing palm mutes, like a chug part with like low C palm mutes, and there's really a lot of energy in like the 65 hertz fundamental of the guitars, and then you have the bass guitar an octave below that, and it will also have fundamental like harmonics to the fundamentals at the exact same frequency where the fundamental of the guitar is. And if you then tune your kick drum so that the most of the energy is also around 60 hertz, you will have a lot going on at around 60. You will have like probably a pretty boomy low end, and below that and above that will be less going on. So you might want to tune your kick drum or choose a sample in a way that it's maybe between the 30 of the bass and the 60 of the guitars, or that it has a lot of knock above that, especially if you're going fast and you want punchiness and like you want it less muddy. Maybe you could place the kick drum above that even. But you should definitely think about the tuning and look at it and analyze it. Sometimes it's not just about listening, it's about looking at it as well. And at least it helps. And then you can place all those things strategically in the low end so that they work together well.
Yes. Yeah. Like, what are they actually playing is such a big part of it too. There's a reason that the bass guitar and the kick drum sync up so much. It's because you're now choosing to make them work together rather than against each other, because they are occupying frequencies really close to each other. You need them to like coordinate with each other rather than compete against each other. So it's like half what frequencies are these instruments representing and half how are they interacting and corresponding with each other.
Yes, totally. And you will need to you will find that you need less work to carve out space later if you do that properly, because if the kick drum already occupies a space where it's not the fundamental of most of the guitar chords or the bass, you both can live there without a problem or with less of a problem. And it leads to a fuller low end in the end. So you as a producer or recording engineer or a self-recording band, when you think like that and when you think about the final result and about what a mixer will have to do with it, it really helps. Because, yeah, the mixer can make a much denser, create a much denser, cooler low end and fill all the gaps if you did the prep work for that, basically, with your arrangement. So, yeah, then what's next? It's really hard to think about that. It's just an exhausting topic to talk about, I'm just finding, because it's like, it's not easy. So
this is a very technical episode in the end.
In the end, yeah. I thought it would be more about like perception and how you feel it, more about that, but you can't really do it without some technical info. So I hope you can still follow along. We basically covered that, the writing and arrangement. It's like, what purpose does every instrument serve? What is there? What do you have in your arrangement? What needs to be there? And where exactly should it sit? And once you've answered these questions, once you've done that exercise, you can answer the next question, and that is, how do I get it to do exactly what it's supposed to do in the recording?
Right.
What can I do to capture it in a way that it does exactly that?
Yeah, so maybe we should just give some examples. Like, I like, generally, my preference is kick below the bass. I kind of give priority for the sub stuff to my kick drum. And that invariably means that with my bass guitar, I'm happy to get some more, like, mid-range going on to kind of compensate for maybe having a little less sub, because I've left that open for the kick drum kind of thing. And then, like you were just describing, they now can kind of fit together. And when they both hit at the same time, they're not stepping on each other. They're working together and creating a full low end. So how do we do that in the real world? For me, it's just like dialing in. I feel like you have more control with a bass guitar than you do with a kick drum. Because the drum, like, you probably don't have a bunch of different kick drums sitting around in a DIY studio. You probably have one, right? And you might not even have like an option for skins or anything like that. Even microphones, you might only have the one kick mic that really works for you. I would probably recommend focus on just getting a good kick sound, not necessarily sculpting it, because you're also normally starting with kick. So you don't really have a lot to base your picture on. But now that you've got a drum set recorded, you've got to sculpt a bass tone to that drum sound if you're going in that order anyways, right? So it's like what we've talked about so many times before on this podcast, is that we really recommend committing as you go to kind of, because you're making decisions in the context of what you've built. So we've got a drum kit that is kind of locked in because you are capturing a drum kit. But now with a bass guitar, you have the option of, you know, guitar pedals, amps, amp sims, whatever. And you can use that to sculpt to your kick drum, for example. So have your bassist play or yourself play to the recorded kick drum and start sculpting the low end of that bass until it fits what you've already laid down on the drums. Does that make sense? Am I speaking eloquently enough?
Awesome. Yeah, you do, much more so than I do, actually. But yeah, totally. Agree with everything. Start with one thing, define how it should sound, and then make the others go along with it. Totally. And if you've done the exercise before that, and if you've thought about it when you're writing and imagining the song and building everything and thinking about the arrangement, it should be easier because you already know you want a pillowy, very low kick drum, or you want a more of the knock, more of the thump, a little higher up there. Mm-hmm. So you've already decided that basically, and then you can make the kick drum sound exactly that, and then you can move on to the bass and make it work together. So yeah, I'm the same, by the way. I'm also enjoying kick below bass most of the time. Sometimes I do something where the kick is below and above the bass. So I have like the subs filled with the kick. Yeah. Then the bass covers like the 80 to, I don't know, 120 or 60 to 120. I don't know, something like that. And then above that, between like around 150 or so, a little bit kick drum comes back in, often from the rooms or the overheads or the kick drum itself. So I have the lows and I have the knock, but in between I create space for the bass. That makes sense. Sometimes I have that.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And what that sounds like for people listening is that the note of the low end is still held by the bass guitar. So you've got like impact and oomph of subwoofer from your kick drum, but there's still a really like melodic root note coming from the bass guitar. That's something that always sounds awesome in your mixes, Benny.
Thank you. Thanks. That's something I like to do. But sometimes, you described that really well. Now I didn't think about it that way, but that's totally true. If you do what a lot of people do and you cut the bass off below a certain frequency, and that's like rather high up. So if you like put a low cut at 80 or something, or I don't know, or even higher, then all the very low information will be from the kick drum. So you're only getting a pulse, but not a mm-hmm. musical melodic information down there. But if you let the bass live down there as well and kind of make space in between the lower and upper part of the kick drum, you get exactly that. You get the notes as well. Yeah, totally. Yes. You're right.
A cool way to think about this that I don't do enough, but I want to start trying to experiment with more, is thinking about tempo as well when you're discussing low end. Because a lot of older mixes like Michael Jackson and stuff like that has bass below the kick, and Bob Marley stuff as well, you know, like really fat low end, a lot of soul recordings, big low end on the bass guitar especially. And I think a reason that works so well in some of those genres compared to like faster rock stuff is because of the tempo of the song, and bass guitars sustain much longer than kick drums in general. So if the song is fast, we need that low end to be tighter and gone quicker, right? Because it's happening more often. The kick drum's happening every once in a while. And if it's still like ringing out down, that subwoofer's still moving when the next hit happens, it just doesn't translate very well. So a slower tempo song, I think you should probably experiment with moving that bass guitar down into the sub area versus a faster song letting the kick drum control down there.
Yes.
That's not a rule, but it's something to consider.
Yes, true. But I've actually, yes, it's totally right. And I think that's a reason for why those productions back then sounded like that. But actually, sometimes I do the exact opposite. I, with like very fast metal songs, for example, I sometimes make the kick drum less subby just because I want the fast double kick parts to be tighter and like not as muddy. And sometimes those same bands use like very low tuned guitars and basses. So I want the low the low string of the bass guitar to be really there, and I don't want to cut anything off. I don't want to mess with the internal balance of the instrument, so I don't want to get rid of some of the fundamentals and others are still there, so I want to leave that in. And as we know, as we've heard, it goes down to 30 or something, so the bass guitar really occupies that. And then I need a lot more of the punch and knock from the bass drum a little higher up. So sometimes I do that, but sometimes, depending on how it sounds, I do exactly what Malcolm just said, and I let the kick drum live down there. It also depends on the player a lot, I think. Some bass guitars, yeah. Some bassists, to be honest, and sorry, but I need to say it again, we're not attacking bass players here, but here we are again. Some, or many bass players, actually, to be very honest, simply also don't play tight and precise enough to let them have all the low end. So if a bass player wants, like if you want your bass to be down there and really dominate the low end and be full and fat, then it should be tight. The timing should be tight and it should be consistent more than anything. Because what you don't want is an inconsistent low end that comes in and goes away, like, and you can't really predict it and it's not in a musical way. That's the worst. So if you want to have a very subby, low end heavy bass guitar, you better play really great.
Yeah. Yeah, shout out to Richie Jackson, a podcast listener who called us on always making fun of bass players.
Yeah.
We actually love bass. Like, tracking bass is one of my favorite parts of the recording process. And mixing bass is definitely one of my favorite things as well. but for some reason, we're always cracking jokes at bass's expense.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, the thing is, if a drummer is bad, and though it's not to say that drummers are always good and bassists are always bad players, but if a drummer hits inconsistently, you can easily replace their kick drum with a sample and make for a consistent low end there. And you can quantize and do all sorts of things. But if a bass performance is really inconsistent on there, like other than like re-record it or program it, there's not so much you can do. And that's why you really need to deliver, you bass players out there. So
that's funny.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's one decision. Bass and kick drum, that's a practical example, absolutely. And how do you do that? I mean, part of it is the tuning of the bass drum. Part of it is like a big part of it is the tuning or the sample choice if you program drums. Well, so that's like the shell size and then the actual tuning, how low you tune it. The choice of bass and sustain. Yeah, exactly. Oh yeah, that's a good one actually. You need to dampen it more if you want it tighter, and if you want that pillowy full long low end, you can have it more open.
Yeah. Think Zeppelin.
Yes, totally. Mm-hmm. Also, but I also think that's something I wanted to add to your example with the older productions. Another reason for the drums not having as much low end back then is, I think, or at least I assume, that they didn't rely as heavily on like the close mics back then on some productions.
Yes.
Especially with like the soul stuff, or if you say Zeppelin or something, you have a long low end, but it's not super subby because you don't have the proximity effect and they are not sticking a kick drum mic right into the kick drum, but they are using like room mics, overheads, Glyn Johns method, stuff like that. And this will naturally have a lot less of the very subby low end. But the bass guitar is either recorded directly or like mic from an amp that will have all the low end. So I think that could also be a reason for them having like low end heavy bass guitars and like mid-rangeier drums.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, the production has changed so much. There's that story about some guy working on the Beatles and not being allowed, like working at, I think they were like RCA or something, and you weren't allowed to bring the mics within 4 feet of the drum kit. And then he just did it anyways, and it like transformed how we record drums. You know, it's like, can you imagine? Like,
yeah.
No, keep those mics away. Like, what?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, they were like these white... What's the name for it?
Lab coats
back then.
Like, scientists.
Totally. They were scientists and they didn't want to destroy the mics. And they, today and nowadays, everything's close mic'd and everything needs to have low end and everything needs to be big and fat. And that makes it harder. It makes for like fuller sounding, bigger sounding productions, but it also makes it harder to get it right. Back then, the decision was kind of easy. The only really low thing was the bass guitar. So,
yeah.
Okay. So the tuning, then the choice of instrument as well, of course, like a 5-string bass will have a different low end to a 4-string bass. if you actually play that fifth string. So, but
actually, you know, even if you don't, you know, the low E on a five string sounds different than a four string.
Yeah,
it's just like a different tension scale thing. So
you're right.
Take that into consideration too.
Yeah. Yeah, then the placement in the room maybe is also something that where you can manipulate that. If you put your kick drum, for example, like your drum kit, into the corner of a room, it will probably sound boomier and have more low end than if you put it in the like somewhere around the center or the middle of the room. And then there will be spots where the low end cancels almost entirely, and there will be spots where you have low end buildup. So walking around the room and finding a great spot for the kit is definitely worth doing and will completely change the way your low end sounds. There's an exercise that I like to do, and I got it from a book called Mixing with Your Mind. It's a very, very great book that you should check out, pick up. It's not very cheap. It's like $80 or something, but it's one of the best books I've ever read.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's super awesome. Because he explains things, the author explains things in a non-technical way, but almost always tries to explain why you do something and how it makes the listener feel. And it's just it's a different approach and it's awesome. It's just good. And what he does, and I do that all the time since I read that, is like just grab a floor tom and walk around your room hitting that floor tom and listen to what the low end sounds like. If it's boomy, if it's thin, if it's tight and punchy, just walk around hitting that floor tom. Go into the corners, go through all the spots in the room and just listen only to the low end. Like, how long is it? How loud is it? How defined is it? What does the room, the reverb sound like? But only listen for the low aspects of it. And then you find a spot that just works beautifully for whatever you want to try to do. So, yeah.
Yeah. I've seen people do that with a snare drum, but the floor tom makes more sense.
Yeah, if it's about the low end as well. But with the snare drum, I can see that too. That's more about, I think, the room sound, the reflections, the attack.
Yeah, more
the
about
the
like flutters and stuff.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But when it comes to low end, like a low-tuned floor tom, it's a great way to do that. So, yeah. What else can you do there? Obviously, when the source sounds right and you made the tuning and instrument choice and room decisions, then it gets to the engineering part of it. What can you do to manipulate what you're recording?
Yeah, yeah, like choosing mics that go down that low, right? Like if you're using just some more narrow dynamic mics, you're not going to really capture a lot of that sub stuff, and that's going to reflect in the recording. It's not necessarily a bad choice, but it should always be a conscious choice, right? If you want that low information, you need to make sure you're trying to capture it. Do you use a U47 on anything? I know I've brought that mic up before.
Yeah. Yes, I like to use it. I don't own one, but I used it a lot of times. A couple of times in other places. It's a very expensive mic if it's an original one, but I've used a bunch of different U47 clones, and they all were great, like all different, but all awesome. All did some kind of the same thing. What I really like about them, and that brings us back to the low end thing, is I like the U47 FETs or the clones of that. Like,
yeah.
Not the tube version, but the FET version, because that has like a really full and clean low end. So you can put it right in front of a bass drum, very up close up to the bass drum. It doesn't distort. It has a full low end. It's just beautiful and big sounding. The tube ones tend to distort earlier and have more more of a color to them. And it's not as, like the low end is just not as clean and therefore not as big.
Mm-hmm.
So
I like the FET one too, and it's same like on a bass cab, it just rocks. That mic just makes me appreciate low end very much.
Totally.
So I was curious what you use for those situations.
Yeah, these days actually I use the Slate mic a lot. It works. Like it has a U47 awesome. Model in there, and you can even for low end stuff. I sometimes use it just without any model. I just use the clean flat mic because it goes flat straight down to like 20. And it's just super clean. It has super a lot of headroom. And it's like, just gives you the low end. It represents the low end exactly as what it is. And so I sometimes like to do that even without any emulation on it.
Cool.
And little budget tip here, something that my assistant Thomas and I found out lately, or I found it out, but I used his mic to do that and he was kind of interested in it. He owns an Aston Origin mic, which is like if you're familiar with that brand, it's like, they make affordable but great sounding condenser mics, or not nowadays even dynamics, I think, but they started with condenser mics.
Right.
And the Origin is, I don't know how much it is, but it's really affordable for a great condenser microphone. And he has that, and I tried it in front of a kick drum, and I used it in a couple of production where I engineered and he assisted, and it's it works very, very, very well. I really fell in love with it, and I used it on a couple of drum kits now. So if you own that, or if you're planning on getting like an all-round condenser microphone, the Aston Origin is I can recommend that as well for low-end instruments.
I've never used one, but I know a couple of people that swear by them. It's like the people that own them are just diehard fans.
Yeah, I see why. It's cool. It's awesome. So yeah, go ahead. Mic choices. Obviously condensers and stuff like kick drum mics probably.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like even, you know, this decision comes down to even like your room mics and stuff like that. Like I'm a big fan of ribbon mics for rooms because they're darker and more focused. Like that leads to a more low mid, upper bass focus on my room mics kind of thing. So talking about like the thud in a kick drum, you get a lot of that if you tailor your room mics the right way. To focus on that kind of frequency. So, I mean, we're talking about drums a lot here, but the same choices apply to whatever you're recording, I think. Good thing to keep in mind is like the EQ filters on a mic as well. You know, like if you're cutting out the subs, you're not going to capture much, obviously. But like people forget to check those things all the time. They just throw up the mic and it's like, sounds a little weird, but it's because you're cutting out everything below 80 hertz.
Yeah. True. And sometimes these can go very, very high up. With like the SM7 that I'm using right now, it has a low-cut filter and I don't use it at all on my voice. I used it once and then I thought, wow, this sounds really, really thin. And then I figured out that in this case, the low-cut goes up to 300, I think.
Holy crap. Yep. I did not know that.
Yep. So no wonder it sounds thin. So what? You never know. Yeah. It's true. It's a very flat low cut, but it goes up very, very high. And it's very thin sounding, actually. You need to go very, very, like it compensates for if you're really eating the mic, if you're like close like this and you have like a very deep voice like Malcolm does, then you, maybe you could use that switch. But with my voice, I just sound like a chipmunk, like without being, like it was not like pitched up, obviously, but like it sounded like it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But those filters can be great, can be not so great. Just know that they are there and try and use them to shape your sounds. You can EQ things in the box or with analog gear, obviously, if you have a desk or a preamp with EQ or something like that, an analog outboard EQ. But you can use also, you can record through plugins, as we've talked about in this podcast before. You can make those decisions right away. As we said, we want you to be bold here and to make decisions. So if you're sure, if you know what you're doing, just EQ it. It's just a part of the process. But a lot can be done with like good instrument choice, tuning, and microphone placement. And I think placement is huge here when it comes to low end, especially. So yeah, are there certain things like what do you do when it comes to like miking bass or making kick drums, making guitars, when you think about low end?
Well, the thing that came to mind when you were just talking is that if it's not there when you record it, it's not going to be there ever. That's why it's so important with low end. Like top end is pretty easy to make up for, I think. Where low end is like impossible. If it's not captured, you are going to have to do some serious voodoo to get it to come through in a mix, which invariably leads to compromises somewhere else, right? So you really need to make sure that you're accurately tracking a low end that represents what you're trying to get. Like a lot of low end isn't necessarily a good thing. It has to be the right low end and the right amount and sound good, right? So, you know, I would just really urge you to not settle until it's there. If your kick drum just doesn't have anything to it, that's a problem and you should really sort it out. Same, especially your bass guitar, actually, I think, because that's like, it's a whole point. But man, I'm just picking on basses again. I don't know. I kind of lost myself there, but like it is so important that you just you really listen and are honest with yourself that you are capturing what you're intending to.
Yeah, totally. With the placement, I find that the most important thing probably is the distance with like proximity effect and everything. So when it comes to like tactics, what you can actually do is besides the mic choice, then I think playing with the distance the closer you get, the more low end you have, the further away you get, the less low end you get. It's about like things, the rest is like specific. You need to, exactly, as Malcolm said, you need to listen what the thing you're recording sounds like and where the best spot to put the mic in at is. So with a guitar cab, there's certain things you can do. The further out you put the microphone from the speaker, the more low end you have. If you put it dead center, you will have less low end. With like an acoustic guitar, there will be a spot where you have a lot of low mid range or low end of the acoustic guitar, and there will be spots where you don't have as much. With every instrument, there's going to be a spot where there's going to be a sweet spot, and there's going to be an area where it's too much and an area where it's not enough. And you just got to define what you want, then listen to what the source sounds like, then pick a microphone that can reproduce what you're trying to capture, and then put it in the right spot. That's the thought process, basically.
This has been a big episode.
Yeah, I didn't expect that to be that long.
There's so much to think about.
Yeah, I hope you could follow along. It was a little more confusing than I thought it would be. But I think the main takeaway here is you need to listen to what we said when it comes to making, like thinking about those things, deciding those things, the why behind what you do more than the what. So it's a less of a technical episode. It's more, it should get you thinking about the whole low-end issue, and it should, you should make a plan and get a vision for what you want your low end to sound like. I think that's the main takeaway here. Just have a plan, be strategic and intentional about it, and not just put as much bass in everything as you can just because you think it's bigger or fuller. That's, I think, the takeaway. Be intentional. Know that not everything can be everywhere at the same time in the low end. Know that there's going to be a compromise. Make sure you do it clever enough so that the compromises are minimal. Yeah, just make sure that things work together and not just on their own.
Yeah, and just be like, I think another key takeaway is that if you aren't able to like discern what we're talking about when you hear something, you need to develop that skill. You need to develop the ability to critically listen to material and pick out the different kind of frequency areas, and be able to hone in and just assess the sub of a mix, or just the low bass. And by doing that and learning to kind of dissect something you're listening to, you'll be able to make those, like, use that same skill set when you're making your own decisions and capturing your own instruments.
Yeah, totally. You know what? Oh, my voice just went a little crazy. But yeah, it was the chipmunk again. You know what? What I'm going to do, thinking about all that, I just pulled up something that's actually just part of the course. So that's something only people who bought the course or buy the course will see. But I just decided I'm going to make a free download out of it for you. So have this frequency chart and spectrum overview is what I called it. So I think the URL will just be theselfrecordingband.com/frequency chart. So as soon as the episode's out, this will be available. And it's going to be a free download. And what that is it's a PDF that's actually inside the course, as I said. And it has the whole chart of like every note and its corresponding like hertz value for like all the octaves, the whole spectrum. So you can see where the fundamentals actually are. And it also has a description of all the areas of the whole spectrum, like sub bass, bass, upper bass, low mids, mids, high mids, treble, everything above that. Like it has a description for all those areas. So I tried to put it into words. It can help you like learn what that actually is and what lives in a certain area, how that should feel or sound. And then one more thing, there is a 4 or 5 page PDF. And then there is a graphic where I divided the spectrum into different parts and I put the hertz values and the notes in there, but I also put stuff in there like this is where the harmonics of the bass guitar are, this is where the fundamentals of the bass guitar are, this is where whatever is. So you can see visually where certain things typically live, and then you have the written description of those areas, if that makes sense. It will make sense once you see it. So I'm going to make a free download out of that. It's going to be the selfrecordingband.com/frequency chart, and it's just one of the many, many things that are in this course. So there's not only videos, but it's also like PDFs and worksheets and stuff like that. And that's one of them. I guess that's it. Let's wrap it up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it, man. There's a lot in there. I think we just really encourage you to check out the article that we've mentioned like countless times through this, how to get your low end right before mixing, which was the selfrecordingband.com/lowend.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
That will, like, I would read that first, listen to the episode, and then read it again, yeah, and it'll all make sense the second time.
Yeah. And we can all just hope that whatever Thomas makes out of this episode once he edits it will make much more sense than what I remember it to be right now.
Yeah, I'm like, I need to have a nap. I'm tired.
Yeah, exactly.
Need to listen to this and make notes. But yeah, that was good.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you for listening. Hope that brought some clarity and didn't add to the confusion around this topic. And
sometimes you have to get more confused to learn.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, let us know what you think. As always, like, comment below the various like social media posts when this episode goes out. Leave us a review. Send us an email. Choose some way to reach us and just let us know what you think about all this. Definitely. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
See ya.
Hey friend, thanks again for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this one, just know that this is just a tiny fraction, a small taste of what we can actually do to help you completely transform your recordings and mixes forever. If you are really serious about your music, if you want to reach your goals as a self-recording artist, then please apply now for the Self-Recording Syndicate, our coaching program that takes you from where you are to being able to completely independently produce and release exciting sounding music forever. If you join that program, you're going to be part of a very, very passionate, dedicated, committed group of self-recording artists from all around the world, and you're going to get a roadmap, guidance, feedback, personal access to me and the team. We're going to do everything, literally everything we can to help you make the best recordings you can possibly make. And it all starts with a free first call, completely free, no strings attached. Best case scenario, we're going to end up working together and we're going to completely transform the way your music sounds. Worst case scenario, you're going to get an hour of free coaching and an action plan that you can then take and implement on your own. So if that sounds interesting to you, get started now with your first completely free call by going to theselfrecordingband.com/call or just click the link in the show notes. See you next week.